The documentary that took myself and my colleague Annie Kelly about a year to make really looks at how women in both jails and prisons in the U.S. are being cherry-picked, basically, out of incarceration, not only through the bond system, but through a system that has a lot of different areas of access. So this will include letters, websites, money on people's accounts, and also picking the women up straight out of the jail. So the bond system is another big element to that. So women who come to court and cannot pay their bond can easily be picked up by traffickers.
So these are women, the most vulnerable women, usually, who are in prison. Yes. Very often nonviolent drug offenders serving time.
Yes, they are women who have been spending, you know, it could be typically they're in the jail. So a large proportion of these women are in jails, but they also are in prisons as well. And they are in there for a variety of drug offenses, potential prostitution offenses. And these offenses, Maeve, are all visible online most of the time. So anyone can look anyone up in prison. They could see their inmate number. They can see their list of charges. They can see their home address when they get released, and when they can visit them. So it's completely and utterly public. So for women who are incredibly vulnerable, while it's good to be able to have communication to the outside world, many, many, many people on numerous occasions write to them and contact them who they don't know.
Give us a sense of the scope of this. I mean, you spoke to many survivors of this, so we can only imagine how many people are still left in the trafficking world. But give us a sense of the scope. How many women are we talking about?
Well, we spoke to dozens and dozens of women. I myself went into jails in the U.S., particularly in Massachusetts, to see it firsthand happening, and I did. A number of women had lots of letters, were recruited, and I spoke to survivors who had this happen, and we would say we basically did different things to see the scope of this. We went inside jails and prisons and talked to women and looked at it firsthand happening. We spoke to survivors of this happening, and we also sent out a big survey across the survivors' trafficking networks to see if women had in fact been a part of this, had in fact been trafficked straight out of incarceration. And what we found was a huge response rate across many, many U.S. states. I mean, I would say over 20 states where women had had that happen to them. So we wanted to corroborate this, not only happening in the first most and only prosecuted case in Florida, the Richard Rawls case, but that this was not a one-off. This was not exceptional. This was actually more common than people believe.
Is this organized crime networks? Are these individual pimps targeting these women? I mean, what's the scope of the perpetrators and the predators?
That's a really interesting question. And I would say what we found typically is that it is really single traffickers most of the time who see this as an opportunity. They see this as a easy way to pick out vulnerable victims. But this is a network in the sense that they all talk to each other, right? So traffickers and pimps post online to talk about how you can contact these women and get these women. Sex buyers, you know, Johns, they do this as well on websites. And when I went, in fact, to Texas to interview two different traffickers to corroborate this happening, they completely corroborated everything that we had researched.
When these women are trafficked out of prison, I mean, a relationship is established somehow with this pimp or this predator, either through letters or visiting or putting money on their account while they're in the prison or the jail or they're bonded out. What then happens once these women are out of prison and out of jail?
Well, let me back up a little bit and just say this grooming process and how this actually could happen very, very quickly. You know, when you have nothing, anything in prison, anything in jail means something. People who have no family, they have no money, they have nowhere to go. When you're actually in jail, you know, you're the lowest you can be, you know, just spending time with these women, you know, they've lost everything, their children, their families, their hope. They get somebody who writes them or contacts them and says, "You matter to me. You're a beautiful woman. I love you. I will give you the love you need." And we saw this again and again. And they want to believe it. They want to believe they can have a different outcome when they get out this time. And these people know this. They know this is the kind of thing to hook them. And so when they get out, they're faced with a number of things. There could be debt bondage, right? So it could be money that's been put on books. Now you owe me. And a lot of women said that, right? Now you owe me. I just need you to go and sell your body and do this, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't happen so blatantly like that sometimes, but it can happen. They pick them up from the jails. They pick them up from the courthouses. We were there and witnessed that happening all the time when we were in Massachusetts. So they can pick them up. They're waiting for them. They're ready for them. And so then women go with them. And it can happen very quickly or it can happen a bit slowly over time. You know, it could be a romantic, ostensibly romantic relationship. Within 2-3 weeks, it starts to deteriorate very rapidly and the women are back on the street selling their body for the drugs they've been given to keep them hooked. Or it could happen very, very quickly and they are immediately in a violent situation where they cannot escape.
It seems that one of the key elements to this is the easy access to all of the information about these women who are in prison.
Yeah. So some states, I mean, this is a state by state decision. This is the Department of Corrections making these decisions typically. And some states have tried to make efforts where you cannot just look up somebody by their vital statistics. Right. But traffickers talk about it like they can pick a woman off a menu. OK, they can put the age range they want. They can put the eye color they want, the hair color they want, the weight they want, the drug offense, the offense they want to see who's vulnerable. In other states, you have to know the name of the inmate. But even that can still reveal a lot, right? These are not just online. They're printed in newspapers and daily local newspapers. So you can see somebody who's going to appear in court and what charges they have, so you know when to go and meet them. There is no privacy. And so our system works, and this is where we kind of come and indict it a little bit. Our system works that once you become part of the state, you get owned by the state, you have no rights. You have no right to privacy. You have no right to your own personal protection.
Is there any movement to change any of this? Or is there even an acknowledgement that this problem exists and that these women are incredibly vulnerable and are being trafficked in this way?
There are very few examples of states actually taking charge of this. There is human trafficking kind of awareness courses that are put on some of the jails and prisons and things like that. But if the correctional officers and people are not trained adequately, they cannot catch this happening. Most of them are trained in catching maybe gang language in letters, but no one is catching grooming language in letters, right? And this is how it all begins. And they also believe that once those people leave, the moment they walk out that door, it's not their problem anymore. And that's really all the way from high up. So that comes from the top down. We were able to, we came to understand that, you know, there was an alert put out on the Eastern Seaboard about this as a trend happening amongst law enforcement as an alert. And we noted that some jails were trying to take action and found evidence of this. But in terms of it being a kind of ongoing training, no, that's not happening.
And also it seems that a major component is just the issue of incarceration for nonviolent drug offences. And then what happens when these women are in there? I mean, we've had reports on about women having to buy feminine hygiene products, women having to buy toilet paper while they're in prisons. And so they're incredibly vulnerable when they're going in, and then they're put into an even more vulnerable situation, basically, you know, for the picking for the traffickers.
You know, one thing I really learned about this in the process of doing the story, I had never really spent days and days on end in a jail or prison. And I was able to do that in Massachusetts. And it, you know, psychologically affected me in a way that I'd never experienced before. You know, the experience of being in a prison, you know, is nothing, you know, compared to the women who spend every day in there. But it's very upsetting because you spend a lot of time there. There is complete disconnect from the outside world. You know, while you have people writing to you, you also are completely disconnected in any other way. And there's also an interesting environment, particularly in the women's jails, of a status, okay? So in every jail, there's a hierarchy. And when you have nothing, when you have no money, when you have no ability to buy a cup of coffee and share with another woman, you don't have any implements to write or have a snack or anything like that, you know, immediately you're put into a category and you're treated as a pariah. You're treated totally excluded. So for many women, it's just about belonging in a place too and feeling protected within the jail. So there's dynamics going on inside the jail as well that make women feel bad, make women feel like nothing. So when somebody offers them a bit of money, of course they're going to take it, right? So there's that kind of situation too. And when they get out, they get maybe $50 in a bus ticket, right? So for women who maybe are in there for drugs, you know, are they going to rebuild their life on $50 and a bus ticket, right? So there isn't a lot of options for when they get out. And what I saw going back numerous times to the same place is women out on the streets, back in the jails, and then women back on the streets. So I saw firsthand the cycle, the meaningless cycle of incarceration and exploitation, and then back into incarceration.
In terms of the criminalization of these women, it seems that the laws are set up to criminalize the women. Addiction has been criminalized. So many are in for nonviolent drug offenses. It's underlying an addiction, a public health problem. But then also the prostitution laws. I mean, are there laws there that facilitate the prosecution of the pimps and the traffickers? Or are we just going to continue to see the women being criminalized?
There isn't, in my observations and things, it's very difficult to, there's a lot of resources that are demanded in prosecuting a trafficker. There's some good work going on at the federal level and in some cases the state level, but it takes a lot of resources. With Backpage closing down due to new laws against, solicitation online, that just means that they've gone further underground. So there are a lot of resources that are required, and it means better intelligence, and it means that it's much easier to arrest a woman and throw her in jail because, you know, your key indicators show that you're making arrests. There has been responses from authorities that they no longer arrest women for prostitution, but these women are being picked up for all sorts of nonviolent drug offenses and all sorts of other ways that they're being arrested. So, you know, it takes a commitment by the cities and the states and by the federal government to not just give lip service to human trafficking victims, but to follow their journey and their course all the way through to the end, to where they do not need to be continually punished and not have their own children given back to them and not be able to get a job. They need to be able to clear their records as well. So, you know, it takes a multi-sectoral response to this, but also just a new way of seeing this huge population of vulnerable women before they get trafficked. You know, women on the streets who have drug substance abuse issues and maybe have had to have survival sex to survive are prime candidates for exploitation. And someone told me the other day, a very established lawyer at Brooklyn Law, that the same people that are being arrested are the same people that are being exploited, right? So we're seeing that this is all one in the same population.
Well, Mei-Ling McNamara is the director and producer of this half-hour documentary just being released. It's called The Trap, and you can see it on the Guardian websites. They have lots of different platforms and maybe in some other venues as well. We will put links online at kgnu.org. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.